to me, the core of Indianness is polytheism. Polytheism means that you respect different people's truths. You don't have one truth. It's not monotheistic. It's not about, hey, one God, one way, one book, one thing. It's about respecting, hey, your journey may be different from mine. Your truth may be different from mine, but I should allow you, I should support you, and you support me, and there's no reason why we need to fight about it, right? And so there are animists, and there are Buddhists, and there are tree worshippers, and snake worshippers, and Muslims, and Jews, and Christians, and they've always been over thousands of years. And
this is the Indianness Podcast, stories of success from leaders and change makers of Indian origin. Why have Indians achieved success across so many different disciplines around the globe? I have no idea, but let's find out together, because every story is unique. I'm very excited to have Raju Rajan with us today. He's the chief technologist of US East Global for Hewlett Packard. He's also served in leadership roles at Cisco and IBM, but also the founder and president of Rewild Long Island, an environmental nonprofit. I invited him on this show as I was intrigued by his journey from being in research and then an entrepreneur and now a C-level executive. Welcome, Raju. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Pleasure to be here, Sanjay. I really appreciate you having me here.
Wonderful. Raju, as mentioned to you before, our show basically captures the journey of change makers like you, which serves as a journal for you, your family, but also as a log of inspiration for others who want to follow in your footsteps. So in order to capture the journey, we kind of have to go to the beginning of the journey. So can you please share with us where you were born and tell us a little bit about your parents?
I was born in Coimbatore in Tamil Nadu, India, but grew up mostly in Chennai, just then called Madras. All my schooling was in Madras till I left for Calcutta to do the Indian Statistical Institute for a degree. Now, as you all know, Chennai is hot and by the ocean and very urban, a really fun city to grow up in. Loved a lot of my experiences there. My parents had actually moved there. Our origin in Chennai was my father's parents had moved to Chennai from a village in Andhra Pradesh. So they were Telugu-speaking folks. My mom, on the other hand, was Tamil-speaking, and she grew up in Coimbatore. She was born and raised in Coimbatore and studied there. And I think my parents actually met in Coimbatore because that was, again, a small town where there is an agricultural university there, where my mother's father was working at that time. And I think my father also had a stint there. So anyway, long story short, they both settled in Chennai. I am one of four siblings. My sister, she's out here in Seattle. My two brothers, who are twins, younger than myself, they are in Florida and Amsterdam. All of them have had corporate careers, though my brother recently decided to retire. But all of us are sort of corporate beings at various hues.
Wonderful, wonderful. So let's just go back a little bit. So mom was obviously from Coimbatore. Dad's parents' family came from Andhra Pradesh. So we had this whole Telugu-Tamil combination. And then you were in Coimbatore till what age there?
Months. She and my mother had gone to have the baby and then she came back, I'm sure, to Chennai. I think at that point, my dad worked possibly in Voltas in Bombay for a few years before coming back to Chennai. But essentially, all my memories are of Chennai.
Now, Dad was he an engineer at Voltas?
What was his profession? So my father, actually, very interesting journey of his. Because, and I think when you talk about successful Indians, though I don't want to make it sound like everybody is uniformly successful, I think there's a little bit of a sampling bias here. We remember the successful ones and the people we don't consider successful, we hardly remember them. But it's also about the rural to urban migration within India, right? So it's a question of which generation made that transition from a rural area where, you know, a lot of us, at least my family, they would have been traditionally land owning on both sides. They were Brahmins. I don't say that as a matter of pride, but just as a matter of record. Mm-hmm. So definitely they came from a background where knowledge was valued, where they had access to education and literacy, where they had a tradition of knowledge work, combined with they were possibly second children or third children who didn't have as much access to the land, who decided to then move over to the urban area. The fact that they moved early, like at least two generations ago, allowed them to build a certain amount of capital and wealth, even though they, when they made that migration, they were not rich. They were all would fall within sort of the lower clerical cadre of workers. But at that time, still having access to that, coming from a family where people were teachers, readers, around books, not afraid of knowledge. I mean, that really gives a lot of, I've seen quote-unquote successful Indians, a leg up, right? I mean, it's a multi-generational journey. And nobody like, I mean, very few people go from utter illiteracy in one generation to being genius level people in the next generation. And that's not because they aren't capable of it. It's just that a lot of social capital builds over generations. And in that sense, I was pretty fortunate to have parents who themselves had gone to college. I think both my parents were the first of their families to ever go to college. My father went to IIT Kharagpur, which had just opened. So both of them were children of the post-independence generation. So they would have been in their early teens, maybe when at the time of independence, barely. And then they grew up very much in independent India. And there were a lot of opportunities, including IITs that opened up and agricultural colleges and different colleges, universities, which opened up to a lot of our people. And then opportunities for employment, which also correspondingly opened up. So the fact that my father was an engineer, an agricultural engineer, but I'm sorry, he was a mechanical engineer with specialization in agriculture. And he worked in a variety of automobile and transportation related, like Ashok Leyland and Voltas and things like that, right? So that definitely was a big part of his success and a big part of my success, right? So I definitely want to pay my dues where they are owed.
Of course. So Raju, obviously, Dad had a very strong engineering background, but can I just go back to Granddad? What was Granddad doing? He obviously was not educated, as you said, but just tell us a little bit about him.
I had two granddads, needless to say. And so my father's father passed away when he was young. He was barely in school when my father's father passed away. I think they came from some land, but he had lost land in some kind of a whatever. I mean, there's always like family drama around litigation and how somebody was swindled. So we can do the Bollywood version of that but with the songs. So there's always some of that. And then so they came. My grandmother was the person who was very strong. She spoke, I think, about four languages, read, wrote, spoke Hindi, Telugu, Tamil, English fluently. She was a school teacher. She kind of passed a lot of the ethic of discipline and writing and reading to my father. So a lot of what he became was her raising him pretty much as a single parent.
And she was in Coimbatore?
No, this is my father. So they were in Chennai.
They were in Chennai. Okay.
So my father's parents came to Chennai from Andhra Pradesh. My mother's parents, were in Coimbatore. And he was like a clerk in the agricultural university. I think he was taking care of warehousing or logistics or something like that.
Okay. But grandma, was she around when you were growing up?
Yes. Both my grandmothers were around when I was growing up. Both of them were very influential, very strong women in different respects. And my father's mother was quite the personality because she was a school teacher, very strong, very confident, very self-assured, knew her mind, and I think definitely was a presence in our lives. And my mother's mother was always, she was a homemaker. She had eight children, out of whom one passed away, but seven children. So she raised a lot of daughters, seven daughters. And she was, again, a very warm, caring, loving maternal presence in all our lives. So both of them, in fact, they passed away only about a decade or two ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. So when you were in Chennai growing up, Dad did he move back and he stayed in Chennai all the time then?
Yeah, he stayed in Chennai. He was pretty much in Ashok Leyland for all the time, and he climbed the ranks from whatever. And executive joining in as an entry-level executive, worked up the manager chain, and he was like a general manager for spare parts by the time he retired, left, and then moved to another opportunity. But basically, that was a lot of when I was in Chennai, he was an executive. As an executive
at Ashok Leyland.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Now, so when you were growing up, where, which was a school that you were going to at that time?
I went to DAV. All my life, I went to the Dayananda Anglo-Vedic. That's the DAV high school. There's one in, yeah, again, this is very much a function of parents. It's a very much a function of where you find yourself. Actually, I think I joined the year after they started the DAV school in Chennai.
In Chennai?
Right, yeah. So yeah. Pretty much.
CBSE,
I was like
right?
Second. Yeah, it's a CBSE school. My brothers went there as well. And my sister went to Church Park Convent, which is also a very well-known school in Chennai. And the fact was, that's because we grew up in that neighborhood. We grew up in Gopalapuram, where those two schools are. And then we continued to go there all the way through the end. Very good schools. Again, not taking credit for anything. This is all life handed to you on a platter. That's kind of...
Well, so a life handed to you on a platter, but also what you make of the platter. But we'll talk about that later. Were the academics rigorous or did you find them easy?
I found them boring.
Boring?
Meaning I loved to read. So I used to read outside school, whether it is novels, jokes,
like puzzles, what?
Books. Yeah, I mean, you name it. I mean, my mother used to say he reads everything, philosophy to pornography, right? Anything. I'm kind of a compulsive lead reader. So anything that I get my hands on, I read. And some of my best memories in Chennai are, right, everything from the lending libraries. If I don't know, when we used to grow up, I mean, that was the thing. You used to have the lending library around the corner. And then there was the British Embassy, the British Consul Library, the German Consulate Library, the American Consulate. I mean, again, like you'd go and ferret out all the libraries in town where you could get your hands on and get your hands on books of all kinds, right? Like, you know, everything from the Russian puzzle books that we used to get to books on physics, to books on philosophy, to books on, I don't know, trash and pulp fiction and everything, right? Mad Magazine, when you can get your hand on it, right? So I used to love reading. And I mean, I still find it very hard to do something unless I can think of a why. I need to be motivated by a why. And unfortunately, I think school for me was not I didn't have a very strong why. I did not see the connection between having to memorize a whole bunch of different things and spit them out versus, I just didn't think of it. So I think Mark Twain has a famous line saying, I didn't let schooling get in the way of my education. So I hope.
That's a great line.
I did a little bit of that.
Yeah. Now, the books you were reading were all in English or in Tamil or?
Yeah, almost all in English. I was a voracious reader. Again, right, yes. I was a reader and I read English very fluently.
Fiction, non-fiction?
Everything I could get my hands on, anything that I could get my hands on. So I still think of when I was in high school, the books that I would read that I still remember and I love, everything from 1984, Brave New World, a lot of Asimov. Around that time was when I think Gödel, Escher, Bach, the Hofstadter book got released. I remember that that was awesome. Like somehow, I mean, those books were expensive at those, I mean, right? Getting an American book and paying the rupees and dollars was not like cheap. So I still remember.
But you were getting it from the library though, right?
Some of them were available in the library. Some of them, a friend would get it and then it would be like a friend of a friend and then you beg them and you sit in their house and read it just because they won't let you take it out.
That's true. Any Ayn Rand by any chance?
Yeah, I read all of Ayn Rand.
Atlas Shrugged, Fountainhead.
Absolutely. I've read all of, those days, like you used to travel. I mean, that kind of mixes up with my, two of my favorite memories are reading and reading while traveling in buses, trains, and cars.
Buses and trains.
Right? You sit there and just you read and then nobody needs to bug you, nobody to tell you to go and do a homework or this or that or the other because you're just there. So it's a 6-hour journey.
You're in a different world at that time.
Yeah,
you're visualizing.
Exactly. You're reading. You're looking out of the window. You're hanging out. You're in your own zone, and you don't have a care in the world. So really, used to love that. I used to love reading, and I used to love traveling. Right, and apart from family and food, I think those are the three favorite things that you can think of. Right.
Yeah, and do you think books have helped you over a period of time?
Helped is a word that...
Or have played a role.
Of course, it inevitably. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't imagine myself not reading, right? I always have a book or two that I'm either reading or listening to even now, and I continue to
read. But when you were young and reading, maybe some of those things made an impact or things of that nature because it opens our minds Because right now, as you know, reading is a dying art here in our world today, everywhere, because the attention span is very limited. But, you know, that's very interesting what you say. So was DAV mainly all Chennai kids or people from outside were also
there? Oh, no,
there
definitely were a mix. I mean, the origin of DAV is very much, it's an Arya Samaj institution coming out from Punjab.
Yep.
So definitely a lot of quote-unquote North Indian kids, especially Punjabi kids.
From army and stuff like that?
Yeah, army and also businessmen, their children and so on and so forth. Yeah.
So you got good exposure to a variety of cultures there, right?
Of course, yeah. Hindi was my second language. Sanskrit was my third language. I learned Tamil at home. So Hindi, I grew up listening to Hindi. In fact, my brothers all speak it far more fluently than me. And we had friends who were Tamil. We had friends who were Punjabi, Marwadi, Gujarati. I mean, so we grew up in a very, I mean, for Chennai, those days was not as cosmopolitan as it is now. But we grew up in a relatively cosmopolitan atmosphere, given that also my father worked in a company where there were executives from all over India, right? And we traveled quite a bit. So definitely got a lot of exposure, at least within India, to a lot of cultures and religions and languages and food and all that stuff, right? So
That's great.
Amazing.
So in terms of you were going ahead, you made some good friends also at DAV?
Yeah, I definitely was not gregarious in terms of large circles of friends, but the friendships I had were very deep. And the ones that lasted, I mean, the issue with a lot of schooling then and now, right? The emphasis was on IIT. I mean, I think around 47 kids in my class, 45 of them took the joint entrance exam, and there were two of us rebels who refused to do it, right? Mm. And said, look, no, we're going to go study mathematics, because that seemed to be more meaningful to me than doing engineering and becoming a clone of whatever else, right? So I just didn't want to do that. So it's very hard to resist and find meaning, right, in outside that doctor, engineer, narrow.
The two profession rule.
Reference.
We call it the two profession rule, doctor and engineer. Yeah.
The doctor and engineer, right? Exactly. So you either a doctor or an engineer, and you have to decide which one you want to be and try to go and do that. And occasionally you do the commerce and then you do an MBA, right? Or a CIA.
Yeah,
or
then something you're
like
a black
that.
Sheep, but that's
you're
a whole
black sheep, but even then, slightly gray sheep.
Yeah, gray sheep. That's true. So when you came out, when you were at DAV, was mom and dad helping with homework? Was it dad or because of his IIT stuff or mom?
To some extent, yes, but not really. I mean, I think my dad was very busy and my mom didn't quite help with homework. But again, I can't claim to have been a good student at all. My math teacher ignored everybody in my class, came to me and thanked, Rajendran, I'm so glad you passed, right? So he was very happy.
Then I won't see you here again.
That's right. No, exactly. So he was very happy that I passed mathematics. Though the funny thing is I went and got a master's in mathematics and then almost got a PhD in mathematics. But the reason was that it just was not me. I mean, to me, the education
didn't excite
was
you.
Not meaningful.
The why. Yeah. The why was not there is what you're
and
saying.
The why was not there. And I think in some sense, the kids today, I really envy them and I'm so happy for them at a certain level, right? Because the level of access, right? You go on the internet and if there's a concept you want to learn, you don't need to go and just calculus, all right, differential, okay, differentiating x to the power of n is x to the power of n minus 1 times n times x power n minus 1. You don't need to learn the formula and apply it in a context. You can go and look at videos which have a rich combination of audio and video and graphics and synthesis with meaning done by different people from different cultures. You have access to that. It's so much more soul fulfilling to go and understand what it is, be excited by an idea, be captured by, oh, wow, how did that do that? And then you're thinking about, oh, Newton thought about it this way. And then Gauss thought about it this way. And Cauchy thought about it this way. And this subject evolved. And then, hey, these are the problems that still exist in the subject. I mean, approaching anything, whether it's mathematics or music or physics or art or whatever you have a passion for, in a way that is rich and meaningful, is what is important in life. So it's, for me, it took me a long time to realize what my passion was. And I think till you know what you're passionate about, you're just going to execute. You're just going to go, I mean, so being successful, quote unquote, is just a function of, okay, listening to what they want, what your expectations of people around you are, whether they're your parents or your teacher or your boss or your professor, and just executing to their expectations. And then saying, all right, I gave myself a good score because everybody is happy with me. But does it fundamentally change anything in your life or made you a better person or made the world a better place? That's not clear, right? So till you have a certain passion and have a sense of purpose, life does not, at least my life did not sort of click into place. And a lot of my life was just figuring out what I loved and shutting out the noise around me of what other people valued and emphasizing what I valued and spending more of my time and finding more of my rewards in what I value versus what the expectations around me were or what other people around me were going for. I mean, at least that's my journey. I don't mean to be either boastful or...
No, it's a great journey. As you said, finding out what you're passionate about and what the purpose is, I think it's very critical because as one of our guests said, if you're passionate about doing something, even if you fail at it, you won't have any pain because you really enjoyed what you were doing.
Exactly.
And I think that's what you're basically saying. And that comes across so many ways. So, as you said, 45 out of 47 kids were going for the IIT, and there were two rebels who decided they wanted to go for math. And I'm talking to one of those two. So, you decided that you wanted to do math. And then what happened? You graduated out of DAV. So
I went to Vivekananda College, Madras University, got my bachelor's in math. Then I went to ISI, Indian Statistical Institute.
Very prestigious institution.
I love them. I wish I had known about them when I graduated high school because I could have gone there for my statistics bachelor's. But that's okay. I got a master's in statistics probability theory from the Indian Statistical Institute. Again, I have very fond memories because very smart, some of the smartest people I've ever known in my life.
Yep.
Were hanging out, and none of us were rich, but we were extremely, what I can say is that it's you're young and you're passionate about ideas and you're with people whom you like and who have similar passions. That is a joy and that lifts all of you up. So in that sense, I'm very grateful to the Indian Statistical Institute and the culture they created. It was not a IIT-like competitive, here we selected the top 0.1 percentile and you're all going to go and become CEOs, right, after doing engineering. That's not the culture. The culture was, hey, here's this discovery, here's the knowledge, here's statistics, here's probability theory, here's Kolmogorov, here's Markov, you had that intellectual tradition that you were part of. And whether it was Dr. Murto Sen, there are so many luminaries of Indian statistics who were associated with that place. So it was very much the best tradition of Indian emphasis on knowledge and scholarship together with a Western mathematical tradition and a Western emphasis on Western scholarship blending together very nicely in their campus. So I'm very grateful to them. And then I decided to do a PhD actually in mathematics and I went to University of Wisconsin-Madison. But while I went down that path, I realized that doing a PhD in mathematics was not my cup of tea just because I didn't feel I was good enough to be like an outstanding mathematician. And I just didn't want to do a teaching. I didn't want to sit around teaching people math, right? I thought that especially people who were not as interested in math. Though, you know, now I think, you know what? I could have made it interesting for them. But I didn't quite think that way at that time. So I went and did a PhD in electrical engineering instead, which was really a mathematical PhD, because I kind of knew enough mathematics that I could. My wife still laughs about me changing a bulb or changing the electrical system. But anyway, I think it was in communication networks and was a largely mathematical PhD. And that allowed me to join IBM in the research lab when I graduated.
Good. Well, just to go back a little bit, you went to Vivekananda for first your undergrad, right?
Mm-hmm.
How was that experience going from school to undergrad?
It was just like an extension of school. I mean, it was a very peaceful, calm atmosphere. Okay. It was very fairly straightforward. It was school without the requirement of attendance, which was perfectly compatible with my lifestyle at that point in time. Exactly what I needed. I mean, I actually was also learning German at the Max Müller Bauen, which is a Deutsche Institute. I mean, I've always been active in a lot of different other things, right? Like when I was in high school, I was in the RSS. When I was left, I was in NCC. I organized. I've always had a streak of myself where I'm organizing, doing other activities, whether it is in the theater or drama or literature or activism or reading and writing or scholarship or going and learning languages. I've always liked doing. I mean, I'm not somebody who says, okay, here's the syllabus. You shall learn this and I will question you at the end of this. That is not usually my cup of tea. My cup of tea is here's a problem. Please figure out how to solve it, or better still, pose a better problem and solve it. And then in the course of it, learn whatever you need to, or invent whatever you need to learn the problem. I'm much better at purposeful problem solving, like learning, interactive, rather than a syllabus driven, here's chapter one, definition one, axiom one, theorem one, here's a question on that, right? It's taken me a long time. I thought it was something wrong with myself, or I was bored or lazy or this. When you're young, you kind of imbibe the values that are around you. So that's why I tell a lot of my nephews, nieces, grandkids, whatever, like I don't have grandkids, but nephews, nieces, I tell them, look, especially kids who are smart and not doing well at school, I tell them it's not your fault. It's just the education is not consistent with how you learn. And we standardize education and industrialize education and make it look like car manufacturing or Ford assembly line or something like that. And a lot of kids don't make it that way, right? I mean, a lot of kids are not built to make it that way. And you saw me the other day, Sanjay, right? Like I always on my, even now when I work, I'm on my treadmill walking all the time. I can't sit and do things. I mean, I kind of feel bored. I have to be multitasking, or I have to be doing one. It's just for me. I mean, it's just how we are built. And I think that there's a much greater appreciation for that individual mode of learning in the United States now, and increasingly in India, I should not say that, than it was when we were growing up. When we were growing up, hey, if you are not learning, you're buddhu or you're alsi or you're laparwa.
I've heard some of those terms, Raju. Sorry. You're bringing back memories, unfortunately. But you're touching on some very important points, Raju, because education has become a one-size-fits-all to a large extent. But because of technology, we might be getting into personalized education. But anyway, that we won't go
That's a very good point. Absolutely.
But so from Vivekananda, you said, okay, it was good. What made you decide to go to the Indian Statistical Institute at that point?
One of my, actually, I told you, the other guy that did not do math.
Yeah, the two out of 47.
Yes, Anand, one of my close friends at that time, he told me about that and said that they are very good and that they are one of the best places to learn mathematics in India. Even though they're a statistical institute, they have an excellent program in mathematics and probability theory, especially in stochastics. So that ended up being the reason I went.
Don't you think the Statistical Institute is like one of the better kept secrets in India? I mean, it's like the best. I've heard such amazing things about it, but you all hear about IITs and stuff. And that's not to say IITs are great, don't get me wrong, because we have a lot of guests from IIT here. But the Indian Statistical Institute is supposed to be awesome too.
Yeah, it's IIT without the rat race, right? I mean, so you take the rats out of it and just have the cheese. I've seen this a lot I've had tons of friends who are IIT, so I don't want to.
They are listening. Remember that, Raju. They will be listening.
I'm glad.
We are not going to edit that portion for you.
Absolutely. Please don't. Oh, no. Look, what makes that institution great is the amazing quality of students that they have in there. There are some of the most,
The self-selection process.
Exactly. My college roommates from Wisconsin, Ramalingam and Sudarshan, they're both like toppers from IIT Madras. My mentor and a PhD professor, Rajiv Agarwal, was from IIT Lucknow. So plenty of people in my life who have been from the IITs, they're very, very smart. They're excellent. But what I've often found is they've had to come out and learn the why and sort of relearn several of the things. So it's kind of like four wasted years. You took like really brilliant people, and instead of unlocking their creativity, you unlock their competitiveness. Right? And they are amazing people. That doesn't take away from them. So, whereas I don't think there was the same competitive pressure at the Indian Statistical Institute. There was more of an emphasis on learning and knowing, and there was an emphasis on being smart, but definitely an emphasis on what do you do with that smartness and enjoying mathematics, enjoying probability. There was that sense that ultimately the goal of it was to enjoy and learn and grow, not master. You were nowhere near mastering any of mathematics. And we were very aware of it. So you were like this little kid standing in front of the ocean for the first time and saying, wow.
So was the why answered for you at the Statistical Institute?
Yes and no. So for me, I've had to constantly reinvent myself, right? I've been through a lot of different professions or professional identities. So I've been a mathematician. I've been an engineer, PhD graduating. I've been a corporate research. Then I have gone and founded two startups. So I've been a technologist. Then I have been in large corporations. I've been facing sales, facing pre-sales. And right now, I'm an account chief technologist who sells large technology solutions to very large enterprises. So I deal with corporate clients all the time. And on the side, at the same time, I've always been an activist. I've worked on multiple projects, like starting from when I was a kid, working with the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh to working on the left. We formed a youth solidarity summer, a first progressive South Asian youth camp in New York. I worked with my friend Biju Matthew on the taxi worker strike in New York. I worked on, now I do environmental activism with young people. So I've always kept different hats on. One is sort of professionally doing the things that need to be done in order to turn the crank and finding a certain set of joy in that. But I think purpose is more, for me at least, socially focused, right? It's what can we do to make the world a better place? Specifically, now I'm kind of more focused around people and communities and the environment, climate change, biodiversity, resilience, both in India and here. So that's kind of where my mind, I mean, all the technology that I invent or think of, or innovations I think of, I always think, okay, how is this going to make the latest and greatest, I don't know, whatever, you go in from 7 nanometer to 4 nanometer and put the latest computing device out there and consume less energy. That excites me less and less as time goes on. The question for me is, okay, what is its impact? Why does it make the world a better place? Yeah, I understand why it makes my friends in Silicon Valley rich, or even myself richer, but why does it make the world a better place? So that's really where my head is at and where my passion is at. And sort of that, by making my purpose more and more focused on that, I have generally found more, I've been able to cut the noise a lot about whatever is happening professionally, not worrying too much about what that is happening, letting that slide, meaning keeping on top of it without letting that get to become the core of my identity, and instead becoming focused on, hey, how does this help other people and other beings around us?
Yeah. So where do you think you get this, I don't know, whatever the word is, activism, advocacy streak in you? Dad was an engineer. He didn't have too much of that going on. Mom, grandparents?
My mom is definitely, yeah. My mom, grandparents. You should remember that my parents were the first generation in free India, right? So they grew up nationalists. They grew up, like, my mom still remembers going outside and seeing Gandhiji, right? Like, they all remember waving Indian flags at independence. They all remember. So that generation still had a lot of idealism left over. Oh, you can still see that. Like, the movies we watched growing up, a lot of them had social themes. They all had a deep political meaning. They were all engaged in communities. They were all talking about, hey, how do we make India better? How do we, with this gift of freedom, how do we make people equal? How do we liberate women? How do we make sure Dalits can have a voice? I mean, so a lot of that has been present in India. And so for me, and again, it was part of the reading. I always read a lot and I cared a lot about the world. So in some sense, my world was not the school syllabus or the college syllabus, the school expectations. I always was, right, whether you read Ayn Rand or whether you read George Orwell, you cannot help but think and engage with the world in different ways and say, okay, what makes the world a better place?
Yeah, whether you read Ayn Rand or Alistair MacLean or any of those things. So that's very interesting. Tell me, Raju, that when you landed in Wisconsin, how was that? Because Chennai to Wisconsin, I would say, what, 30-degree difference, 40-degree difference?
Much more than that, yeah. I imagine, yeah. So like land in, yeah, lots of interesting stories. I landed in Chicago, got my bag with my passport and everything stolen, and then I was so grateful that I had a family friend, Dr. Trini, and his family who came and helped me right then and there and helped me get that. And then I went to Wisconsin. And so it was kind of like a pretty traumatic landing there and then turning around and finding your bag gone. Anyway, so Wisconsin is amazing, right? I mean, I just came in. It's, again, right, again, a very rich tradition of both academics as well as activism. So really very good professors, very good learning environment, very good students. At the same time, there's always been a tradition of left activism in Wisconsin. I was part of many different groups there, from nuclear disarmament to fighting the Iraq war to the local insurgent newspaper. I had a radio show at one point, or at least a South Asian radio, our first progressive South Asian radio show, which we formed as a group there. So which is why I'm kind of familiar with the equipment now and the levels. So I've done a lot of sitting around with splicing tape in the middle of the night and doing interviews, right, at that time. GATT and WTO and all of those were big concerns. So I was very much engaged. So for me, Wisconsin was just a continuation of the journey, both on the academic side as well as in terms of activism and engagement with the world, finding how different people approached it, right? I mean, it was a much stronger compared to where I was. So coming from a background where I went to DAV, which was a boys' school, to Kananda College, which was an all-men school, to Indian Statistical Institute, which was largely men, to an environment where there was a lot more women and feminism, and a lot of my feminist friends and my women friends who were feminists, I really thanked them. I had friends who were studying sociology and literature and women's studies. And so in being able to engage freely and openly, to be active with them, there was a lot of exchange. I mean, it's like you can't help grow, as you said, right? You said, do you have books have an impact on you, or people have an impact on you? You can't help. You go outside that safe zone and start engaging with people. And whether it's AIDS activism, which was, again, still big in the early 90s because nobody was paying attention to it. And that was when people were dying. Gay men were dying at a huge rate, right? So anytime you engage, these are subjects that you don't, now you discuss them in India, right? Now it's okay to have a gay rights movement in India. And there are, at least in the large cities, there are queer people are out and trans people are out. But at that point in time, just Chennai boy coming up, showing up in Madison, Wisconsin, and finding all these like ideas going off in his head, right? So it's really important. And I really think that wherever I have been and wherever I have, whatever I have done, I've kept that two tracks of one, continuing the line of traditional Indian American success. And the other, the best of, I really believe the best of what America has to offer, like a progressive vision and radical politics.
No, that's fantastic. Incredible. What, as you said, you have to get out of your safe zone. That's what you said. And engage with people. And I think a lot of us either are too lazy or sometimes afraid to doing that. So really kudos to you. So when, Raju, you graduated from Wisconsin, what was the plan then?
The plan was to either a research lab or an academic position, because I had a PhD and I was still enamored of doing research. I went to IBM research because, again, that was a good place to do networking research. We were building the first switch router at that time. My manager at that time was Rock Garen. My another manager at that time, Arvind Krishna, has now become slightly higher up in that organization. So very, again, good atmosphere, right? I loved the work at IBM.
This was in New York?
Yeah, Hawthorne. Right, north of the labs are north of New York City. And I love the fact that I could go down into the city and meet with my friends, Matthew and Bhairavi Desai and Vijay Prashad and a lot
for
of people.
For the taxi stuff?
Absolutely. They were organizing the Taxi Workers Alliance at that point in time. So I used to hang out and do a lot of activism, do some activism around that. And then we also did a forum of the Indian left. And then we did a Youth Solidarity Summer, which was amazing. I think it was the first progressive Indian American or South Asian American camp. So we were a bunch of young people who were recruiting high school kids and college kids, second generation largely, to come in and say, okay, let's define exactly to the heart of your podcast, what is Indianness? They all grew up with a sense that Indianness was, oh my God, if they were Hindu, they thought it was Bharatanatyam and Bhagavad Gita. And if they were Muslim, they thought it was this and this. And everybody thought being Indian is being heteronormative and disciplined and wake up and don't question your parents. And India has such a rich tradition of dissent. India has a tradition of atheism. India has a tradition of Marxism. India has a tradition of women speaking up.
Tradition of everything that you can think of, man.
Exactly. So, which is why we had to introduce, because their parents were sure as heck not telling them about it. So somebody had to. And so it was fun. It was fun.
That's fantastic. So how many years at IBM?
I was at IBM for about 5 years. Then I was in T Labs for another couple of years.
In Jersey?
Yes.
In New Jersey?
Yeah, Florham Park. Then I founded a startup and did that for about 8 years. I founded startups in Philadelphia and did that for 8 years before coming back to corporate life. My startup life started around 9/11. So a great time to raise money, and ended around Lehman Brothers. Another great time to raise money. So,
yeah, you got two bookends that you covered very well. No, but that's fantastic. And now, obviously, you're at HP. And simultaneously, I mean, doing the corporate thing, but also this environmental stuff has become activism has become a big part of who you are right now.
Exactly. Absolutely. I spend quite a little, every non-working hour, so to speak, doing something or the other. I mean, I always keep myself active. I have a farm in India, in Coimbatore, where I grew up. I mean, actually, my father had bought that land, and about 4 or 5 years ago, he passed it on to me before he passed last year. And he has always had a passion for trees. He's been an agricultural engineer. You can never take the farm out of most Desis. So he always loved gardening. He loved trees. He had a passion for education. He loved educating children. I mean, you're still very idealistic about how children need to be nurtured and educated and how we need to have biodiversity and protect it. So so he didn't have a very clear plan for the land. Based on my environmental knowledge and activism here, I decided to, Coimbatore, very interesting, right? So the Western Ghats, which stretch from, say, the tip of Kerala all the way into Mumbai and into Maharashtra, right? That is one of the 10 biodiversity hotspots in the world. It is an incredibly rich ecoregion, like with multiple ecoregions. It's got everything from like your elephants and tigers and large mammals and things to butterflies, uncountable species of butterflies, birds, bees, bats, you name it. I mean, and those species are disappearing really fast. Even now, when I go back to Coimbatore, so I have my land is right nestling right next to the forest reserve there. So, and what is happening there is what is happening here. So you go to back to your Indianness and Americanness, right? So the America is coming to India, right? And America comes in the form of the suburb. The suburban model of how you build houses. Everybody wants to have, the aspirational goal is everybody wants a house that is set back from the street, wants a strip of lawn in front of it, wants the same 5 plants, the rose, the hydrangea, whatever, this, the tulip in front of their thing. They want a swimming pool in the backyard and they want to put Italian marble in their house and they heat and cool their house using fossil fuels, right? So, I mean, maybe that's a stereotype. Maybe different people have different variants on it. But largely, when you go back and look at what is happening to land outside cities, that's essentially what's happening. Agricultural land, forest lands are getting grabbed. Everything is being put under the tractor and you're getting these homogeneous suburban developments for an aspirational middle class and an urbanizing class. Now, what happens to biodiversity? What happens to the species? Where does a butterfly go, right? Where does a bee go? Where does the elephant go? Because the elephants, those are traditional migration paths of elephants. You can't take an elephant and put it in a 20-acre park and say, here's another 30-acre park and you shall not go between these two. Elephants have been migrating for hundreds of miles or for God knows how many millions of years, right? So it's really understanding that the basis of biodiversity is our native trees. So trees that have grown up in India, trees and vegetation and perennials that evolved in India, have a whole bunch of beings that co-evolved with them. There are birds that depend on them for nesting. There are specific butterflies that will only lay their eggs on certain plants. There are bees that are ground nesting bees that require habitat. There are bats that require. There are thousands of things that require habitat, and that will only be possible with native trees and plants in there. And so my farm, it's not huge. It's just 4 acres. But basically what I decided to do was put in a whole bunch of native trees. I have like over 100, 125 different species of native trees in there. So that's what I did. I went and I had somebody plow the land and I sat there and I got a truck driven in with the hundreds of saplings and then sat there planting it one fine December. And I go back every December, even this December, I'll go back. I'll go and getting everything in India is like a little bit of a, you have to know how, whether you get a bore well dug or a drip irrigation put in or electricity put in. So it was a learning experience. I've never been a farmer. So a lot of it is learning. And likewise, here, the same thing. We need native plants in our suburbs. We can't afford to let lawn grass as the number one plant. And it's not native to anywhere. It's native to, I don't know, Central Europe, right? It's not native to India or the United States. And a whole bunch of effort, like everything from fracked chemicals to urea to insecticide, herbicide, machinery goes into maintaining that lawn. And that's a whole bunch of pumped water from aquifers and rivers and streams that go to just running your lawn. So it's just not sustainable. It's detrimental to biodiversity. It's not a great way to maintain your waters. It's just not, and it's not soul satisfying, right? You go and you find a sterile ecosystem. You may as well go and put a piece of green plastic outside your house for all that it matters, right? It's not, you have a monoculture there that's not feeding anything that doesn't, it just looks like everything that in a glossy magazine, again, you're living out somebody else's dream because that's what your realtor magazine told you that your house needs to look like in order to make your neighbors happy and yourself successful. And that's what you're running. But a bird can't live there. we can't live there. So really thinking about your landscapes and spaces around you as habitats for other beings and being able to provide for them and provide for yourself and find out what nourishes your soul. That's what I find happy. I mean, my happiness, I love being around trees. I love being around plants. I love gardening. I love putting my hand in the ground. I love putting my hand in the ground and pulling out earthworms. I mean, it just means the soil is rich. I love composting. I love building water barrels. So all of that stuff I love, and that's what I do a lot of now.
Oh, fantastic. Obviously, you're very passionate about this, Raju. That's great. So Raju, when you look back your time, obviously in Chennai, then you obviously Vivekananda and others, can you just briefly tell us a couple of two or three of your favorite childhood memories?
Childhood memories, as I said, like the things that I loved about my childhood were eating, reading, and going places in a car, bus, train. And ideally, going in places in a car, bus, train while eating and reading would have been the trifecta.
That's fantastic. No, that's amazing. Raju, you kind of have alluded to it, but and a lot of our guests talk about the role of mentors in their life, and they come in many shapes, sizes, informal, formal, father, grandfather, mother, etc. What has the role of mentors been, so to speak, in your life?
I mean, the word mentor brings out a certain resonance, but let me say people who are definitely influential in my life.
Right? Yeah, influential. Okay.
The funny thing is that a lot of them are dead authors, right? So it's not your mentorship. I mean, again, this is the Indian idea of a guru, right? If you have an Indian idea of a guru, like the story of Ekalavya, who had a guru who he never met. He just heard about him. He made a little statue. So your guru does not have to be like your mentor or your influence does not have to be alive or even know that you exist. And they can influence you. So, I mean, so from that point of view, there are innumerable influences. But definitely, my mother is a very strong person. She's been a wonderful influence in our lives. A very strong, intelligent, articulate woman. Very passionate, brilliant in her own ways. So definitely, she's an awesome influence, not just on me and but she had seven sisters, and she had to get all of them married off and be successful in her own life and make an entire. So she was somebody who carried an entire khandan, an entire kinship network forward and took the weight of that on their shoulders and did it. And that is highly underrated. I mean, you never find a professional guide saying kinship uplifter or something like that as a profession. Yeah. But there are many women who have gone through and done that for our families. And that is an enormous set of skills, right, to pull that off and personality and influence. Definitely my PhD thesis advisor, Rajiv Agarwal, continues to be a friend and a great influence. Again, great. We've had a very good mental engagement in terms of being able to value intellectual accomplishment and do things for the sake of a passion, right? Just being able to do things for a passion rather than a purpose, not for, hey, is it going to be make me richer or is it going to make me more famous or is it going to make me a better job? But just is it going to make me happier doing this complicated thing, which I think is extremely important. Likewise, I mean, and, you know, sort of my wife continues to be a huge influence on my life. And so have a lot of women friends that I have had and that I have met in this country, especially growing up in the background that we have in India, where it was a very much more patriarchal society than possibly it is now, with very much assumptions around caste privilege, around the eldest son. I was the first son in our multiple generations, but whatever, sort of being that, being having a certain sense of entitlement around class, around access to English, around urbanization, around what schools you go to. So there's an enormous amount of privilege that you inherit in India, and that stays invisible to you until good friends and good influences make those visible and teach you how to use that. And you know, it's not a question of saying, oh, now I'm ashamed of being a Brahmin, or I'm ashamed of being South Indian, or I'm ashamed of speaking Tamil. It's not a question of that's a kind of a very childish approach to it, right? It's a question of, okay, yes, that is a privilege. And yes, acknowledging that privilege did come at the cost of other people, right? But how can we use that now? How do we go forward from here? How do we take that and make sure that we're not reproducing the same structure of privilege and lack of privilege? How do we make sure, especially for me, when I do my environmental activism, I come across high school kids, whether they are East Asian, whether they are South Asian, whether they are white, whether they're black, whether they're Hispanic, they're all filled with passion for climates. They're all climate aware. They are all filled with a care for the earth. They all do amazing things like we pull invasives, we plant native plants, we grow food, which is then donated to food pantries. We sort of compost, we recycle, we plant oysters in the bay. So we do all of that. Like I run the program for this year. We had about 55 students who graduated and four of them decided to go on to careers in the environment. But how do we make privilege and how do we make knowledge and things like that, mentorship available to others and not propagate what we receive, right? Just mindlessly. That's really propagate the better things, what we receive, and not propagate the ones that are not were dysfunctional or resulted in inequality, right? So that's who I think are my influences, right? Like the people who set me on the path to being a better person.
No, that's fantastic to know. Obviously, mom's been a big part. Raju, you obviously have come very far in this journey. But briefly, where do you see this journey going forward? And it's very hard to predict these days, but where do you see this journey going?
I would say two things, right? So three. One is in terms of, I just still feel a lot of obligation, not family and community. I still feel a lot of obligation to India. So I really want to, whether it is through my farm or through other ways, see if I can make an impact on the environment as well as in the lives of young people who are coming of age there, especially kids who, just like my grandfather, maybe their father moved to the city for the first time and they are first generation urbanites and going to a public school, local public school, and then coming up from there. They are our future citizens of India and future citizens of the world. So I do have plans and ways to try and reach them and continue my work both in India as well as here. So definitely I hope to make some kind of a continued social commitment and social impact as much as I can. And on the personal side, I think there's definitely room for personal growth. I mean, again, Indianness and Americanness, both, it's a traditional, in traditional India, traditional, meaning whether you look at Buddhist traditions or Jain traditions or Hindu traditions, at a certain age, you become more reflective. In Hinduism, there is a notion of ashrama. So you start from brahmacharya to grahast. And now my grahast is sort of coming to a conclusion. And I will need to think about vanaprastha. I'm building out a forest there. So hopefully somewhere or the other, which is very ideal for me, right? So just thinking, being more reflective, growing as a person, right? So if you kind of go through your life all the time without being aware of yourself and without being consciously being able to improve yourself and be a better person each day, that's kind of like my hope. My hope is like, hey, you have to be disciplined. You have to be self-aware. And a part of American self-help is also like being systematic about it and saying, okay, you know what? I can change myself. I can reinvent myself. If I don't like something, I don't like the fact that I put on a few pounds or I tend to be overweight, I can always like change things about myself. There's nothing about myself that's not malleable and not subject to internal discipline and conscious, thoughtful effort. So that's really, I hope that to bring that awareness and consciousness into my life and have a really good journey with myself and my wife, where my wife's also an activist. She's also somebody who's very socially tuned. So both of us are very much, and thank goodness, thanks to our good fortune and privilege, and as well as, I guess, our own work, we are monetarily or professionally, we won't need things in life. So the question now is, hey, how do you take that and make yourself better and make your community better?
Well, that's great. Being more socially active, I think that's the journey. I think we hear all across the path from you. Raju, at the end, we generally ask the same question, two questions. We call it the lightning round. So very brief, one or two sentence answers. And you kind of have addressed it several times. But maybe just, what is your definition of Indianness?
For me, the core of Indianness is polytheism. Polytheism means that you respect different people's truths. You don't have one truth. It's not monotheistic. It's not about, hey, one God, one way, one book, one thing. It's about respecting, hey, your journey may be different from mine. Your truth may be different from mine. But I should allow you, I should support you. And you support me, and there's no reason why we need to fight about it, right? And so there are animists, and there are Buddhists, and there are tree worshippers, and snake worshippers, and Muslims, and Jews, and Christians, and they've always been over thousands of years. And for me, the heart of India is understanding the enlightenment that everybody brings something to the table, and being respectful, right? Like my wife is Sikh, and the Sikhs have a huge tradition of social service, of working, of bravery, of courage, of sacrifice, right? So being able to respect all these different traditions, taking the best from each tradition and respecting it, for me, that is the heart of Indianness, is polytheism.
Very well said. Taking the best and respecting it. I think that's very, very well said. Final question, Raju. Someone not from your family, somebody who is alive, it could be from India or any part of the world, as long as they're of Indian origin, that you admire, one person.
A non-standard answer is an Israeli Jewish historian called Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote Sapiens. Okay. It's one of the most brilliant books, at least in the recent past, I have read, and I have a huge amount of respect for what he brings. But I think he's at the heart. He's actually a Buddhist, a practicing Buddhist. I think he does Vipassana meditation. And a lot of what he's done is influenced by India. So the point about India is not genetic inheritance.
Okay. So it's that. So he's got Indianness in him, is what
he
you're
has
saying.
He has absolute Indianness in him. He's more okay, Indian than so most Indians.
So we'll make an exception on that. But that's a great answer. And Raju, thank you so much for taking the time, talking about your passion, your journey, inspiring us and inspiring so many others. And really look forward to following this journey and having you be part of this community. We are building this community and really hopefully you'll be part of it. So thanks so much. Really, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Sanjay. I think it was a pleasure chatting with you. And I'm glad you do these like in-depth interviews. You should be the wisest man in the world. And apart from me, I mean, I kind of lowered their average, but I'm sure you're listening to a lot of like really smart people. So that's excellent.
You're humble, but I do listen to very smart people. And guess what happens at the end of every conversation? I come back feeling a little bit smarter, but feeling a little bit more humble and smaller. But it's a privilege and an honor. But thank you, Raju. Thank you so much.
Okay. Right. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Indianist Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future inspirational stories.